De radio, la queridísima Madeline Speed, mi compañero Sergio Pochón y quien les habla, su amiga Hilda Venegas, nos despedimos deseándoles una noche con el deseo de justicia social para nuestros pueblos, que si el presente es de lucha, el futuro es nuestro. Buenas noches y hasta la próxima.
Hey. Hello everyone, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. You might be wondering why I don't have my usual intro here on the show here tonight. And well, we have a few issues with the music right here at CFRU. So I will just, you know, have to forego that just this time, just this one time around. So it's going to be a little more of a, I don't know what you want to call it, Back in the USSR stripped down or something. I mean, maybe something like that, I guess. You know, but we have to work with what we have. You know, we do have to work with what we have. I myself have been not in the studio the last few weeks. I've either been sick or it's been like crazy busy with my work or what have you. So I haven't been here. I've been playing shows I did like last year, earlier this year. You know, as I saw fit, you know, I played the last week. I played the St. Patrick's Day show, which I played last year. Once again, I think that was pretty fitting. You know, it still fit the mood, you know, touched all the themes that needed to be touched on. Now, there is one thing I do want to mention here before we go any further here tonight. And this, of course, well, this does tie in fact, with the shows I was doing last month when I was doing the Black History Month related shows, which I did. I did several of those. I did at least five. And of course, one of the things I mentioned, I don't think I mentioned it that month, but I did, of course, I did a whole show where I talked about it last fall when it happened. And that was when the shooting of a man named Andrew Loku, an African man in Toronto, who was killed by the police last year. You know, he'd been suffering from, they say, like mental illness, you know, like and stuff. Like, and of course, like the police responded to that by shooting him, you know. And, you know, and this is like in an apartment building in Toronto, and they did that late last year. So, of course, there, and recently it was found out that basically the cop who was responsible for shooting him, they didn't want to press charges against him. You know, they want to acquit him of what he did. And so there has been a protest movement of Black Lives Matter, centered on Black Lives Matter Toronto, but you know, involving many, many allies who have been protesting first in front of City Hall, and when they were driven out from the area around City Hall by the police, they then went to protest in front of the police HQ in Toronto, where they still are. You know, there's been multiple attempts to evict them by the cops, but they've, you know, whenever their tents and things get taken down, they just set them back up again, and they're being persistent, they're being strong, they're really taking a stand here. You know, trying to make sure they get justice for Andrew Loku, you know, this man who was murdered by the police in Toronto last year. And of course, if you go online, you will find out that they, you know, there are ways to donate to them, there are ways to support them, because of course they need, you know, they need food, they need warm clothing. It's still pretty cold out there here in March, and you know, there are ways you can support them. So I would encourage you to go online and find out how you can support Black Lives Matter Toronto in this effort to secure justice for Andrew Loku. So really what I want to do here on the show tonight is, because, you know, I can't really use the music, which I originally was going to play. What I'm going to do is I'm going to play a something which I think is very, very fitting, given how many times I've talked about anti-imperialism on this show over the past, you know, basically since it began. You know, like, I mean, this is really one of the core themes of the show is anti-imperialism. And the talk which I want to play is a talk by Michael Parenti I have not played on this show before. Of course, I've played a lot of stuff by Michael Parenti. You know, he's an amazing guy. I've interviewed him. You know, like for the people who don't know, he's a progressive Italian-American scholar. Who does a lot of work around anti-imperialism and anti-capitalism and this sort of thing. And this particular talk, which I want to play here tonight, is a talk which he gave in 1991 basically as the first Gulf War was going on, you know, and as there was like, you know, there was resistance going on in America at that time, like against the first Gulf War. And, you know, by multiple different groups, you'll hear from some of them, in this talk, you know, like some of them will get up and they will speak, introduce Michael Parenti and, talk about some of the work that they were doing, like to support people in Iraq who were being like, you know, bombed, by the United States and killed by the American Empire. You know, these, you know, there were groups in the United States at that time who were trying to stand in solidarity with the people of Iraq, you know, just as there were in 2003. And the reason why I wanted to play this is because it's dealing with a lot of the same situations that we're dealing with right now, you know, where, of course, you know, now, of course, there's threats by the U.S. to intervene in places like Syria. They've already intervened in Libya and, like, flattened the place, and they've already been encouraging Saudi Arabia, their allies in the region, to intervene in places like Yemen. And, you know, like, thousands of people are dying because of this. And, you know, like, this is very much an issue, of course, with the federal election going on, you know, the lead up to the federal election going on in the United States right now. John Pilger, a very noted Australian journalist and a very noted anti-imperialist himself, who I've played stuff on the show from him before, and I have a lot of respect for him. He was talking the other day about how, you know, as much as Donald Trump is a disgusting individual, you know, a horrible human being, and, you know, like, he poses a real threat, you know, to the marginalized peoples within the United States, the colonized peoples within the United States, and, like, you know, immigrants from Latin America and what have you. But in terms of the imperialist threat, you know, the threat to people all around the world, particularly in the Middle East and Africa and places like that, actually it's Hillary Clinton who presents more of a threat. Because, I mean, she's the most hawkish by far when it comes to pushing an imperialist agenda abroad and intervening in other countries and pushing a war agenda around the world. I mean, that's really, she takes the cake big time in this election in terms of the most, you know, the most violent when it comes to foreign policy. And, you know, and that's a very big danger right now. She comes out of the same school of thought that Madeleine Albright and Zbigniew Brzezinski and, you know, frankly, Henry Kissinger and all those kind of people, all these, like, arch-imperialists in recent American history, comes from the same school as them, you know. And, of course, she was the one who was really pushing for intervention in Libya. And, of course, after they killed Gaddafi, you know, she was the one who mentioned that horrible statement, you know, we came, we saw, he died. You know, celebrating the imperialist destruction of an entire nation, you know. So, I mean, it's a scary show in the American election right now. You know, because the Democrats are just as scary, if not more scary, than the Republicans in a lot of ways. You know, so, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that the environment which we're grappling with in the world today. Now, one of the very heartening things is, you know, the Syrian army on the ground in Syria really is doing an amazing job pushing back the pro-American, you know, the pro-American insurgent groups that have been destroying that country for the last, you know, 5 years. You know, now they're really pushing hard. They're about to retake Palmyra. They're about to retake a whole bunch of different areas around the country and lift the siege of places that were under siege. And, you know, there's a lot of progress on the ground from the from these forces which are fighting against imperialism. So, you know, there are things to be encouraged about. There are things to definitely watch out for, but really the fight needs to be kept up against imperialism. So that's really why it's important to remember these kind of things, that there's a history of struggle here, and we really need to keep that going. You know, and it's important to stay mobilized, you know, around these issues. You know, fight against war, fight against imperialism, and keep taking that stand. So without further ado, I'm going to play Michael Parenti's talk, A Critical Assessment of the New World Order, which he gave in 1991. And really, of course, what he's doing is breaking down, you know, the entire structure that emerged after the Cold War in this period of American hegemony, you could say, where the American Empire is projecting power around the world, intervening in all these countries. You know, and this is what the kind of thing he's breaking down in this talk. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. And I guess I'm going to turn it over to Michael Parenti's talk here. Please stay tuned.
Thank you. On behalf of Women's Strike for Peace, AMERT, and the Gulf Peace Team, to a benefit lecture to benefit the relief organizations, a couple of the relief organizations doing work in Iraq to help the victims in Iraq. I'm with Women's Strike for Peace. My name is Lynn Fredrickson. Women's Strike for Peace has been working for disarmament and just foreign policy for 30 years, and we're very happy tonight to be here with you. And I would like to introduce now Joan Drake, who is with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. She was on a delegation to Iraq, the International Women's Gulf Peace Initiative before the war, and she was recently in New York for a hearing of the War Crimes Tribunal against U.S. crimes against Iraq. Joan.
Hello. Thanks very much, Lynn. It's a pleasure to be with all of you tonight and to try, I think, to assess what's been happening to our country, what's been happening to the world over these past few months and years since the tensions in the Gulf mounted and culminated in the terrible bombardment of the people of Iraq and Kuwait during this past several months. I'd like to say that the privilege I had in being in Iraq prior to the bombing is one which I regard with great honor. It was quite honorific to be there at that time. I had the opportunity to see the tremendous work that had been done by the government and by the people of Iraq to repair the damage from the war that they had just come out of after finishing off a whole series of completed renovations and reworking of the infrastructure of the country. In early January of 1991, Iraq was a busy and bustling nation. I can tell you that the streets and highways were better than our own. There was hardly a pothole to be seen. The various governmental systems and agencies that I had a chance to visit, and the non-governmental agencies, and particularly the women's organizations of Iraq, were busy and were trying very hard to avert the war catastrophe that they felt was coming, but that they hoped would not emerge. And I think that those of us here tonight and many of us in the international community were feeling that it would probably resolve itself somewhat in the way that the Cuban Missile Crisis had resolved in 1962, that in the wisdom of world leaders, it would be seen that the sensible thing to do was to avoid war and destruction and to concern oneself and one's nation and the international community as a whole with the preservation of life rather than its destruction. Sadly, that didn't happen. And we're here tonight to try to repair some of the damage, to try to ameliorate some of the injury caused by our nation, by our tax dollars, and by our inability to inject ourselves into the halls of power in such a way that democracy is realized in our day, in our nation, for our time. And I just want to say it's a privilege and an honor to be here with each one of you tonight, because as I look out amongst this audience, I see people who have worked so hard within these recent months and also within past years on the great issues of our day. And I want to just say I think it's worth a round of applause to congratulate each one of you. And I think you should applaud yourselves, because we tend to measure our achievements by what we haven't accomplished. And I think that's a grave error. I think we've seen just in the past several months the building of a massive movement in this country that is trying desperately to bring the country into the 21st century in a sensible and sane fashion. And I think among the people who have most taken this to heart and who have much to contribute to the process is Professor Michael Parenti, and I want you to know I think it's an honor to be here with you tonight and an honor to share this podium with him. And I'd like to say that I think it's a great privilege to introduce to you so distinguished a speaker as Professor Michael Parenti. And you know, I thought a lot about coming here tonight, as you all did, planning for the evening, trying to get everything straight so I'd be here, and over the past several days, thinking back to all the great words and works of Michael Parenti. And one book that I pulled off my shelf, among the many of his that I have read and that perhaps all of you have read, was his book, Democracy for the Few. And this book is 20 years old, and here I have this old, worn out paperback that I understand is the first edition, but from what I heard, there are 5 subsequent editions of this book. So it's clear that hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, have read or know of the words in this book, Democracy for the Few, by Michael Parenti, published in 1973. But I want to read just a few words from this book to you and to say it reads as if it were written today. So we have with us not only a scholar and a gentleman, but a prophet. We have with us tonight Michael Parenti, and those of you who are familiar with his work will know that he has earned all the distinguished titles that American academia affords, namely his Ph.D. in political science from Yale University in 1962, teaching at a number of colleges and universities, and serving as guest professor of political science at many of them. And these universities include Howard University, University of Canterbury, New Zealand, distinguished residence professor at California State University. And you know, I understand that he's going off to London later this year and that he'll be doing a tour in Europe, and it couldn't be more timely. So we're very privileged to have him with us tonight, and it's clear that he brings an international perspective to his work. Among the books that I didn't bring along with me are The Anti-Communist Impulse, published by Random House, Trends and Tragedies of American Foreign Policy, Ethnic and Political Attitudes, Democracy for the Few, which I've just mentioned, now in its 5th edition, Inventing Reality, the Politics of the Mass Media, The Sword and the Dollar, Imperialism, Revolution, and the Arms Race, Make-Believe Media, which is coming out in 2 weeks, so that's a new one. You probably don't know that title, Make-Believe Media, and The Politics of Entertainment. And of course, he has articles in every single one of our publications of note, The Nation, The Progressive, Political Affairs, American Political Science Review, Journal of Politics, and on and on and on. He's appeared on radio and TV talk shows. His lectures have been played on numerous radio stations to enthusiastic audiences. And those of you who are readers of The Nation magazine, as I am from time to time, will know that you can purchase his tapes. They're advertised in The Nation magazine. He's lectured widely on college campuses and before religious, labor, community, and public interest groups around this country and around the world. Those who have read Dr. Parenti's books or heard any of his lectures know also of the radical and forthright nature of his analysis and assessment of United States policy. I'd like to exercise the privilege of the interlocutor and, as I said, quote for you a few words from Dr. Parenti's book, Democracy for the Few. And I thought in preparation our activities in for tonight's benefit on behalf of the victims of the United States air war against Iraq, that they are very timely and worth sharing. Parenti says in his introductory remarks, and I quote, "This book explores how the American political system operates. American governance, as portrayed in most of our textbooks, bears little resemblance to American government as practiced by the men who rule this country. The central theme of this book is that our government represents the privileged few rather than the needy, that there exists a close relationship between political power and economic wealth. The desire to ignore the relationship between private wealth and public power and confine one's attention to more respectable and safer subjects persists within academic circles today. In this book, we will try to confront that relationship." And one reason that I wanted some public acclaim and applause for each one of you sitting here tonight is that I know of the work of many of you, and I know that, like Dr. Parenti, you haven't shirked to face the burning issues of our time. And indeed, it is more secure and it is more safe to not publicly face or address them. But I'm happy to be here tonight and to share with you the words of Dr. Michael Parenti as he looks at our time and our day.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here. Thank you for the nice introduction. My thanks to Cynthia Johnson and all the other people who labored so hard to put this evening together. I was going to talk about George Bush. It's a very unpleasant subject, but I thought I'd start with the heart of it all. President Bush has been called inconsistent lately, and I want to disagree with that. He's called inconsistent because people have noted that in his policy toward China, he is very patient. China has a repressive regime. There are no open political parties or open press and all that stuff. And yet Bush says we should not impose a moral litmus test on China. We should have patience. It's a country that's going through changes that may take a long time. So there's a forbearance in regard to China. The inconsistency, some people say, is the prohibitive approach he shows toward Cuba, for instance, where there is a moral litmus test, where demands are made that they must make all the kinds of reforms that he's not demanding on China, all the kinds of guarantees of personal freedom, although nobody has been killed in Cuba because of their personal views. There are no death squads in Cuba. There are plenty of them in El Salvador. And others have said he's inconsistent because he doesn't make demands on El Salvador, but in fact gives aid to El Salvador. Even that he's been demanding of the Soviet Union, where there's been a wide growth of procedural democracy and dissident opinion and dissident publications. There are more dissident ones than communist ones now. So that the communist ones really are the dissidents practically, and yet there are severe strictures being put on the Soviets. Why this inconsistency? Why this favoritism toward China, and yet why so severe toward the others? Why the favoritism toward El Salvador? I argue there's no inconsistency. There's a hypocrisy in his words and his demands and his postures, but it's very consistent. The one thing that George Bush always is consistent. He's absolutely consistent. And what's consistent about China is that they're opening their doors to private investment, to the multinational corporations, on terms that are very favorable to those multinational corporations. They are privatizing their economy. They are dismantling portions of it. They are providing immense markets of cheap labor. So China has a policy that has been very good for multinational corporate investment, for the acquisition of resources, cheap labor, and wealth. The function of capitalism, the essence of capitalism, is to convert nature into commodities and commodities into capital. And China has been cooperating in a way that Cuba hasn't, nor even the Soviet Union as of yet. And it's also the way that El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala cooperate. The goal of U.S. policy is, I would argue, to make the world safe for private corporate capital investment, to make the world safe for that process of capital accumulation, to make the world safe for multinational corporate control of the land, the labor, the resources, and the markets of other countries. To do all that, you need to maintain a global military machine with literally 800 or 900 bases around the world. You need to maintain fleets that travel the oceans and squadrons and bombers that could hit anywhere. Now, it's argued that that isn't what it's about. Bush, and that's where the hypocrisy comes in, Bush argues that, of course, and others like him, that the professed goal is something else. The goal is, U.S. national security. We need all these bases because we have a, I'm going to take the Bible off for a second. We need all these bases because we had the threat of the Soviet Union. Well, back in the height of the Cold War, I argued that that was never the threat. To be sure, the Soviet Union was a threat. It represented an alternative social system where the land, labor, and resources were being used in a very different way. It also gave aid to other revolutionary movements. So in that sense, it was a threat. But the Soviet Union as an entity itself was not a threat to the United States as a national security entity. And in fact, now that the Soviet menace is evaporating and the Soviets are moving toward a capitalism, now that the Warsaw Bloc has broken up and the communist countries of Eastern Europe have been replaced for the most part by right-wing capitalist countries that are worshipping the most retrograde components of conservative capitalist society, now that that's happening, the question arises, why do we still need this global military machine? For 40 years we heard it was to keep the Russians away from your sister. What is the reason now? Well, we also hear that the professed goal is democracy, that we need all these interventions in places because we are supporting democracy. But the record shows that, in fact, we have intervened to overthrow democracies. Goulart in Brazil, Allende in Chile, Arbenz in Guatemala, Sukarno in Indonesia, Mossadegh in Iran, and you can name a number of others, the Greek democracy in the late 60s. And what these different governments had in common, different governments, different leaders, different languages, different cultures, different politics, and all, what they all had in common is that they were using political democracy to affect economic democracy. And in affecting economic democracy, they were transmitting some portion of the gross national income away from those who control the wealth of the nation to those who work to create the wealth of the nation. If you look at Allende's Chile, you'll find in the two brief, brave years that Allende was in power, the gross national income had shifted some 10% or so away from the people who live off interest and dividends and toward the people who live off wages and salaries. And the goal and the function of Bush's policy is not to defend democracy, but in fact to smash those various democracies when they begin to cut into that system of privilege, power, and wealth and capital accumulation. Whether the country is a communist country, whether it's a Marxist-Leninist country, or a populist-nationalist coalition, or just a rather conservative nationalist country like Iraq was, the thing is, when those leaders start using some portion of the wealth of that country to do things, frittering it away, wasting it on things like school books and water treatment facilities and clean drinking water and health clinics for people, when they use the money that way, that's just so much less money that's going to Exxon and Chase Manhattan and Mobil and Chevron and General Dynamics and General Motors, and General Electric, and all the other generals. And that's the question. So the goal is to make the world safe for the people in column A against the people in column B. All of humanity is divided into column A and column B. In column A are those people who live off their investments. They live on dividends. They live on the interest on bonds and securities. They live on rents. They live on land and mineral royalties that they earn. They live on a variety of other things like that, the appreciation on speculative investments and so forth and so on. Column B is made up, which I suspect is heavily overrepresented in this room right now. Column B is made up of the people who live principally off their, principally you might have a little CD which gets $500 interest, whatever, but it's not enough to live on. We live off wages, salaries, and pensions and things like that. In Democracy for the Few, I have a line where I say, the trick to getting rich is not to work hard, but to get others to work hard for you. And then I got a little snot letter from a student out on the West Coast saying, dear Dr. Parenti, on page such and such, and he quotes this, I could see him snickering with his fraternity friends as he wrote the letter and saying, I think that's very good advice as to how to get rich, and I would like to get rich. Do you have any further advice as to how I can exploit others and get them to work hard for me so that I could get rich? And he signed it. You know, I've decided I'm not going to debate these people anymore. I write serious letters. I give serious responses. But this letter, his name was Ted something, so I just wrote on it. I said, "Dear Teddy, some asshole sent me this letter and signed your name to it." And I folded it and sent it back to you. Which I don't think is the response he was expecting. But that's a big thing. They don't go out and say, they know you're not going to wave your flag and wrap yourself in yellow ribbons if we say make the world safe for ITT and Exxon. So they say we stop aggression, we've got to save democracy, free Kuwait. I thought this is a fascinating phrase, free Kuwait. You know, I was reminded of what Gandhi once said. Remember when Gandhi stood there and saw the Western colonizers come in and plunder and pilfer and impoverish his country? And then they said to him, "Mr. Gandhi, what do you think of Western civilization?" He said, "It would be a good idea." And I thought, free Kuwait, free Kuwait. It would be a good idea to get rid of the Ammar and all that. But reality shows us something different. There was no fighting for democracy, and the Bill Moyers special just the other night had a clip of Bush saying, we're fighting for democracy, we're fighting for democracy, in that dynamic, powerful way he has of talking, and we're fighting hard for it. There are death squads in Kuwait, there are kangaroo courts, there are people being rounded up, Palestinians, Iraqis, Kuwaitis. The U.S. government to this day and the State Department has not done a thing to get in touch with democratic Kuwaiti forces and representatives of the democratic Kuwaiti forces, has ignored them, has given them no encouragement, which is a dangerous thing to do anyway, as the Kurds learn. So it wasn't to save democracy. It isn't for national security. It is to keep the world safe for the Column A people. And that process, whereby the dominant interests in one country expropriate the land and labor and natural resources and markets of another country, that process has a name. You can never talk about it. You cannot talk about that process, even though it is the most powerful force in the history of the world over the last 500 years. It has shaped the map of the world. It has led to untold numbers of wars and conflicts and murders and atrocities. That process is called imperialism. And that process goes on today just as it went on with the Portuguese in Africa and the French and the Dutch and the Belgians and the British. What these nations did in places like Africa, Latin America, Asia, Ireland, India, what they did in impoverishing these countries. The third world is not underdeveloped. It's overexploited. It's been impoverished and plundered to an incredible degree. The tin, the copper, the bauxite, the manganese, the cotton, the cocoa, the rubber, the oil, the silver, the gold, and the labor, and the slaves, and you can go on and on the list of things that for 500 years the dominant interests of one country, generally Western European, North America, and much later on Japanese, have done to Asia, Africa, and Latin America. That process is still going on today. That process of expropriation. There's very little direct colonization. They no longer own the countries. They just own the economies and control the wealth and much of the infrastructure in these countries. And when a nationalist leader arises, When a leader comes up, be he a Noriega or a Gaddafi or a Saddam Hussein, whatever else he may do, and he may not be a saint, he may have committed any number of crimes of his own, when he has the temerity to begin to interfere with things like the price structure of oil, whatever else, to defend his interests and maximize his income at the expense of the multinationals or at the expense of whatever, it doesn't have to be oil, it could be any other thing, then he must be done away with, even if it's a little tiny country like Grenada. You could say, oh, wait a minute, Grenada isn't an economic threat to the multinationals. What do you got in Grenada? Just nutmeg, and you can always get that nutmeg from Africa. That's right, but the invasion of Grenada And Reagan was right. He said it's not a matter of nutmeg. I said it's the first time I agree with the guy. It's not for a direct economic interest. It's to serve notice to the people of Grenada that they cannot develop an alternative social order. To serve notice to the people of the Caribbean that if any of you try this, this is what you're going to get. You're going to get the 102nd Airborne on your neck. That stuff, that the labor in your country and the resources of your country and the markets of your country belong to us. You get the hole in the ground, you get the pollution, you get the shanty towns, you get the disease, you get the typhoid and the contaminated water systems, you get the bloated kids, you get the starving people, you get the underemployment, but we skim the cream. And if you try to tamper with that, you will get it. In 1954, when Mossadegh was overthrown after he had nationalized the oil of Iran, he was overthrown by the CIA, which was led, the whole CIA project in Iran was led by a man named Kermit Roosevelt, who, after the overthrow of Mossadegh, Kermit Roosevelt was then given as his reward a six-figure salary, 1954, with Gulf Oil Company. That was his reward. And at that time in 1954, the New York Times ran an editorial and said, let this serve notice to other nations who get too extreme-minded that the resources and the investments of responsible elements of the world shall be protected. So I don't have the exact quote. I'm sorry, I should have brought it with me. It said it very explicitly that if you tamper, that oil in your ground belongs to us, and if you touch it, we'll kill you. It's a kind of a national security mafia approach to things. What kind of governments do we want? Not socialist governments, not national self-development governments, not populist reformist governments, not governments of that kind. We want governments, or not we, I mean the ruling interests in this country, want governments that are defined as client-state government. A client-state government is a government that's ruled by a comprador class. A comprador class is a class who defines its interests totally as being totally coterminous with the foreign investors. The Al-Sabah family in Kuwait. The Saudi family in Arabia, in Saudi Arabia. Who literally expropriate. No, in fact, they named the country after them. The country used to be called Arabia, remember? Lawrence of Arabia and Arabian Nights and all that. It's now Saudi Arabia. It's named after the family. They have literally hundreds of billions of dollars. Actually, a couple of trillion dollars, those two families have the equivalent of a couple of trillions of dollars invested in U.S. banks, U.S. corporations, U.S. real estate, and U.S. treasury notes. That's the kind of family they want. That's the kind of ruling class. They want a client state. They don't want a Colonel Nasser in Egypt who nationalizes the Suez Canal and takes the earnings of it to give the Egyptian masses free public education for the first time in 3,000 years of history, free public education. They don't want him. And John Foster Dulles gets up and says President Nasser is the Hitler of the Nile. Remember that one? Hitler of the Nile. They don't want a Gaddafi who comes in Libya and nationalizes the oil and takes the earnings and investments of it and builds reclamation, plants 40 million trees and puts in healthcare systems and redistributes income to the mass of the people, education, all that sort of thing. Gaddafi, a Hitler madman. That's the thing they don't want. They want a client state. They want leaders who say, come on in, here it is, it's all yours, take what you want out of it, you get any name the terms you want, there's no occupational safety laws, there's no environmental protection laws you have to worry about, there's no minimum wage, there's no child labor laws, hire whoever you want. Just make sure you give me my cut, and if they get out of line, if they try to organize and all that, we'll come down on them with our civil guard or our death squads who are trained and financed by your people. Thank you. Well, we got a good little thing going here. That's the client state. And at home, you get the same kind of class war. You may not think so, but look at the last Bush budget. Increased spending for the National Security State, Environmental Protection Agency, frozen at last year's level. Federal retirement programs cut $3 billion. Medicare, this is Bush's proposals, cut $5.5 billion. Children's nutrition cut $400 million. $400 million cut from the children's nutrition, from the WIC program, Women, Infant, Children. While there's, well, Peter Jennings the other night, a little flash, a little flicker, every so often, I remember what C. Wright Mills once said, that in the face of such control and such propaganda and such deception, a simple fact in some kinds sometimes seems like a radical thrust. And Peter Jennings said, there are 12 million children who live in extreme want in America. Many, if not most, don't get enough to eat. By the end of the month, the cupboard is bare and they must go hungry. Well, children's nutrition cut $400 million. $400 million! What the Pentagon spends in 12 hours was cut. Funds for clean water treatment facilities cut 18%. Mass transit funding cut almost 20%. This is Bush's proposal. This is what he's offering the country here. That's taking away from the people in column B so that it can be spent for the people in column A. We hear from conservatives that the public sector spending just takes us down the slippery slope of socialism. But that's not entirely true, by the way. But by the way, this welfare spending, the spending on welfare, the total welfare budget last year was $8.8 billion. That's less than 1% of the budget. That's what was spent on the people below the poverty level. And besides, they do go in for socialism of another kind, a socialism for the rich. There's socialism for the diseconomies of capitalism. For years, I remember, I used to hear about the poverty of Appalachia, the forgotten people of Appalachia. Appalachia was the shame of the nation. We must have a war on poverty. And I wondered, well, isn't that interesting? Who made Appalachia so poor? Appalachia, like Indonesia, like Chile, like Bolivia, like Iran and Iraq, Appalachia is a rich country. It's not poor. It had something very rich. It was called gold. It was called black gold, or coal, as we know it. Coal, the nickname for coal back in the late 1900s was black gold. Appalachia was rich. Ask the Rockefellers and the Mellons and the Morgans. They made a mint out of Appalachia. Only the people are poor. Now, how did that happen? They plundered the area, exploited the people, and leave them. And when we see the poverty, then the problem is socialized. The public will have to pay. And I wondered, why don't the multinational corporations who did all that, why don't they pay? Socialism for environmental devastation. We hear it again. We see CEOs get up there, corporation heads, and say, well, if the public wants to clean up the pollution, it's okay, but the public's going to have to pay for it. We can't do it. We're not big enough. They're just big enough to create the pollution. They're not big enough to pay for it. So they get socialist. Public spending. Let the public do it. The diseconomies are always put on the public. They privatize prosperous industries. They privatize efficient money-making industries. And they put onto the public the ones that are failing and have been milked. That's what they did with the whole railroad system. They made it socialist. After the railroad profiteers had plundered and whatever else, they built Amtrak and all the other things, Conrail, and subsidized it with hundreds of millions of dollars in U.S. funds, billions of dollars in U.S. funds, and now that it's running and it's working again, they're privatizing, they're reprivatizing it and giving it back to the rich. So there's a lot of socialism. There's socialism from Jesse Helms, the little fascist senator from North Carolina. You know Jesse Helms. Tobacco subsidies. One of the most heavily subsidized products in America is tobacco. And Jesse Helms gets up on the Senate floor and he says, this is not a matter of a subsidy. These are human beings we're talking about. Human beings. You see? Unlike food stamps, which of course don't involve human beings. Those are just little pieces of paper, which he cuts and fights and opposes. But subsidies for the big farmers, no socialistic handouts for hungry infants, but for the tobacco industry, okay. For the electronics industry, okay. For the telecommunication industry, okay. For the defense industry, where 70% of the research and development is the equity is provided by the Pentagon itself, Okay, that's all socialism. Socialism for medical schools. Every doctor in America, including the right-wing Neanderthal ones who oppose anything that might cut into their incomes, like socialized medicine. Every doctor in America is subsidized. There's no one who goes through medical school, even if he pays full tuition, who is paying the real full cost of that medical education. There are federal funding of all kinds involved in construction, in plant, in research, and so forth and so on. Funding that's given by tax-paying poor who then cannot even afford to go see the doctors whose taxes have gotten those get those guys through college. Taxes from millions of working poor. There's even socialism to finance the transition from socialism to capitalism in Eastern Europe. The U.S. Enterprise Fund that was put up, that was taken from the public funds, from the taxpayers of America, to help subsidize the privatization of industries in Eastern Europe. So conservatives say they're against government. They say government can't solve the problems. It is the problem. But that's only in the area of human services. That's only in the areas where that might come and cut in on their prerogatives and their powers. They want lots of government, when it's the FBI, when it's police state prevalence, when it's militarism and the like. They preach the gospel of free market. But you see, the truth of the matter is, we tried all that. Everything they talk about today, what we need is no regulations. What we need is a free market really operating. First of all, let's make two things clear. One is there's never been in history any society that's run purely on free market standards. There always have to be regulations and protections of some kind. If you really did pure laissez-faire capitalism, you would tear the society apart. But we had a very close approximation to it. We've done that. And the right that keeps arguing and fighting to get back to it forget that we had it. It was called 1890. And 1890 gave us child labor. It gave us typhoid in our cities, typhoid epidemics in Philadelphia, Chicago. It gave us contaminated food. It gave us widespread poverty and unemployment. It gave us environmental devastation. It gave us no pensions or minimum wage protections. It gave us regressive tax systems. And that's the model that they're trying to move back to. The goal of right-wing conservatism, conservative capitalism in this country, is the third world. It's a third world goal. It's a goal where labor unions will be broken. It's a goal where the capital accumulation process will be increased. It's a goal where capitalism will work better and more successfully. Remember that. We often say capitalism is successful. Look at Austria, or look at West Germany, or look at the Benelux countries, or look at Sweden, or whatever else, or the US or Canada. But those are countries where capitalism isn't working all that successfully. As a social order, it's less oppressed and less miserable. But if you want to see where capitalism really works successfully, you've got to go to Guatemala, you've got to go to Indonesia, you've got to go to the Philippines, and that's where you'll see it working. Just as I said, the client state, where the rate of accumulation is 200% and 300% higher than it is in a country like Sweden, where 80% of the people are in unions, and there's a whole health system, and they cut in on profits, and they tax the rich heavily, and all that sort of thing. So capitalism is most successful where it is doing the thing it is meant to do, which is to accumulate, to amass wealth in order to invest, to amass still more wealth. And that rate of accumulation is much higher in the third world, where you have something close to the free market ideal. I say to students who argue for the free market, I say, would you get on an airliner that is run purely on a free market system? How would you do that? Would you fly on an airline that's run free market? I said, first of all, where would you land? All the airports are socialist. You say, what? They're a little shocked. Yes, all the airports are publicly owned, publicly regulated, with air traffic controls and all that. How else could it work? A purely free market airline, wouldn't that be something? You'd have more choice. You could fly maintenance or non-maintenance. You could see United going, yeah, I'll get in ahead of Delta. We'll get there first, folks. Would you really want that sort of crazy thing? The Gulf War was part of that mythology. I think it was part of looking for new adversaries, creating new adversaries now that there's a shortage of old ones, so as to justify the keeping of this global military machine. And it was also to serve notice to everybody in the Middle East that we call the tune on how your country is going to be run. And if you have the audacity to you have the audacity to oppose us, this is what's going to happen to you. In short, I'd say the Gulf War had three major functions. It had a number of others, too. One was to keep the open door for capital accumulation. Two was to maintain and magnify the military-industrial complex. And three, to keep the global military machine intact and give reasons for it. That war has taught this country the wrong lessons, that if there can be a one-sided slaughter, then it's just. That we can rejoice over our high-tech weapons of mass destruction. This whole idea that Bush should be applauded because the policy was successful, the resolution in Congress, we support our president who unerringly, the phrasing of it was, I mean, it's, you know, that's what they used to do in Nuremberg for Hitler, who unerringly brought us to victory, as if the success of the policy was its own justification. I mean, Hitler took Poland in 2 weeks. Does that mean it was a brilliant, successful campaign? Does that mean it's a policy we support? And even if you didn't like Saddam Hussein, and even if you thought he should get out, is that what you do, murder his people in large numbers? I mean, I hate the government of Guatemala, and I hate the government of El Salvador. But if someone said to me, okay, what we're going to do is carpet bomb Guatemala City and carpet bomb San Salvador and kill 20 or 30,000 people and we'll dislodge the government, I would oppose that with full vigor, because it's not to make war against the people. If you really want to help in El Salvador, what you do is cut off the murderous aid to that army in El Salvador and give direct aid to the democratic forces of El Salvador. And that would be the way to help it. And so this idea... this idea that you demonize the leader and the leader is associated with his people then gives you license to destroy the people. And if you can do that without losing too many of your own, then you've won a really great victory. This is the kind of thing we've got to continue to argue against and educate against. Now, a lot of the American people weren't that vicious, and they weren't that Neanderthal, although they seemed it. The polls show, the surveys done, many people showed that the more they watched television, the more misinformed they were. The more they believed that Saddam Hussein was going to invade Saudi Arabia, the more they believed that the oil supply wouldn't be coming to America. I mean, they had a whole bunch of misapprehensions. The less they knew about Kuwait's slant drilling of the Rumaila oil fields, the less they knew about any number of other things. Another function that the war had was to activate the popularity of the leader. Alexander Hamilton, in his Federalist Paper number 6, argues that many leaders throughout history have, and he wrote this in September of 1789, many leaders have pursued foreign adventures in order to win popularity at home. And if you remember that in July of 1990, George Bush's popularity had dropped 20 points. The SNL scandal was up. The state of the economy was up. Now the air conditioning is back on. I'm just, this, excuse me. I've been writing a book on how the U.S. got into the Spanish-American War. And I found some stunning parallels. If you ask everybody, they all give you the same line. Well, we got into that war in 1898, where the U.S. went in. If the average American is as illiterate about history as the kids coming out of school today, let me just give you a little background. In 1898, the U.S. told Spain to get out of Cuba and started a war with Spain. When Spain was willing to negotiate everything to not have war, to give every concession to the U.S., even give autonomy to Cuba, just to save face, the U.S. pushed and pushed and pushed a war which Spain did not want to fight and was willing to give on everything. And the first battle was not fought in Cuba to save and liberate the brave Cuban people. It was fought in the Philippines to take the Philippines and then Guam and Puerto Rico and then Cuba. And at that time, you had a very interesting thing. The story given out all the time is that it was William Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer who, with their yellow press, sensationalist press, went out there and whipped up a hysteria among the people, and the people forced an unwilling President McKinley into fighting Spain. Well, I found studies in the U.S. Navy Department written in June of 1896, 2 years before the hysteria was supposed to reach its peak. Written, in fact, by a man who was chief of naval operations and later became executive officer of the battleship Maine that went to the harbor in Maine, which called and designated the scenario as to how the war with Cuba, how the war with Spain would come. We would make these demands, we would then send troops to the Philippines, we would then make contact with insurgents and so forth, step by step by step, which is exactly what McKinley did. And I discovered something else, that the people of the United States were not clamoring for war in the 1890s, that in fact, all through from 1893 on, they were clamoring for something else, which was jobs and bread. There had been a devastating depression. There was Coxey's army marching on Washington, millions of unemployed and desperate poor marching through towns and villages and winning the cheers of the people as they passed, many of whom joined them. There were farmers fighting pitched battles against the railroad cartels. There were massive strikes going on. There was child labor. There was all sorts of misery. There was strife of all kinds. And there were any number of people, a Virginia senator who said, what this country needs is a good war to take its mind off all these festering problems. One shot across the bow of a Spanish ship will knock the pus out of the anarchistic, socialistic, populistic boil that defaces our political surface. That's almost a near quote. And repeated quotes like that. Fitzhugh Lee, who was the U.S. consul in Havana, writing to President McKinley and saying, what we need is a war to take the American people's minds off their imaginary ills. Their imaginary ills. Fitzhugh Lee, the Dan Quayle of his day. Fitzhugh Lee, a member of the Southern aristocracy, a former Confederate general, a former slaveholder, the nephew of Robert E. Lee. For that guy, that child labor and poverty and misery, they were the American imaginary ills, you see. And then I came across a populist by the name of Tom Watson, a Georgia populist who led challenges against both the Republican and Democratic parties, and in fact got elected governor, and in fact got elected senator once. And when the Spanish War came, he said, the Spanish War finished us. The blare of the bugle drowned the voice of the reformer. That in fact, once the war begins, you don't necessarily turn opinion that way, but you monopolize opinion visibility and you hype it up in that sense. And the people who are for the war come forward with ever renewed vigor. And many of the other people are concerned about the welfare of the troops and all that, and they too, that peculiar definition of patriotism which equates it with murder and militarism, they too come forward. But Watson had this to say as that war was going on. And that this is 100 years ago in 1898. He wrote as follows. Who gets the benefit of the war? The bond seekers, the capitalists, the railroads? National bankers will profit by this war. The new bonds give them the basis for new banks, and their power is prolonged. The privileged classes all profit by this war. It takes the attention of the people off economic issues and perpetuates the unjust system they have put upon us. Politicians profit by the war. It buries issues they dare not meet. What do the people get out of this war? The fighting and the taxes. Watson goes on. What is the United States doing in this war with Spain in the first place? True, Spain is oppressing Cuba, but so is England oppressing Ireland, Egypt, and India. France is oppressing Siam and Madagascar. Turkey is oppressing Armenia. Should we then take up arms against the oppressors of the world? We would more likely end by becoming oppressors ourselves. The Spaniards and Cubans were bushwhacking one another and killing from 3 to 5 men at a battle. We have gone down there and killed more people in 3 months than they would have killed in 13 years. If they were starving before, who feeds them now? What are we going to get out of this war as a nation? Endless troubles, complications, expense? Republics cannot go into the conquering business and remain republics. Militarism leads to military domination, military despotism. Imperialism smooths the way for the emperor. And as we know, in every president, right, there's an emperor that's just dying to get out. That was me, not Watson, who said that last part. Well, George Santayana years ago said, and it's always quoted like it's biblical and it's the unvarnished truth, he said that those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. I don't believe that for a moment. I don't believe it in regard to our leaders. If they keep repeating history, it's not because they haven't learned the lessons. It's because they learned all too well. If the imperialists of today resemble the imperialists